session number 27074, reel 16.
Squadron leader Bam Bam Burger, reel 16.
It was after the Salerno landing and before the forces pushed further north that it was decided that 243 Squadron would join 322 Wing and we were going to fly to the other side of Italy, to a series of air bases there, Italian air bases. I can't remember. I'd have to look up my logbook to give the name of the place. It was somewhere near Foggia, but a little further south of that. But it wasn't until we got there that we found out what the thing was. That the whole wing of, I think we were three squadron at the time, were going to move to Syria. That was quite an adventure in itself because, I mean, not the sort of thing that was done every day. We were going to fly our Spitfires to Malta, to North Africa. I forget where we first landed in North Africa. Then we had to refuel again at El Adam. And I always remember we landed in a sandstorm. When we landed, we couldn't find our way to go anywhere. We had to be rescued. But that was just one passing in. Then we flew on to the Cairo area. Oh, Lake. What lakes are called there? Lake. Anyway, eventually, we found ourselves just outside of Aleppo in Syria. Now, the object of this move of this 322 wing was, that was highly secret at the time, was to provide air cover for Constantinople if Churchill managed to talk the Turks into coming into the war on the Allies' side. The object by this whole thing was to seize the Romanian oil fields. Now, from my, what I call my career point of view and being an heiress, it turned out a total disaster because really we were just wasted 6 months waiting for something to happen. And all that happened, I think, is the squadron and members of the squadron being in a more civilized, it was an old French airfield we were on. We had actual showers there, primitive showers, but we had a bucket of hot water in a shower. And there was a lot to drink. And it was we arrived there, I think, about 2 weeks before Christmas, 1943, that there was a lot of bad behaviour and goings on, and discipline was somewhat laxed. And there was a station manager called Prosser Hanks, I always remember, who'd been fairly well known earlier in the war, and I think we gave him lots of headaches. Because it was the first time most would have been behaved in a civilized manner for some time, or we should have been behaving in a civilized manner. But we played football and did other ridiculous things. But I won't go into. Oh, that's right. I've forgotten. We were raided by the military police. Because, and I completely put my hands up, I'm innocent. Mainly, I think, more higher-ranking officers had got a lot of loot out of Italy of various kinds, mostly shotguns and that sort of thing. And the military police raided us, and our group captain, Dutch Hugo, as he was of the 322 wing. I know he was sent down to Cairo to be reprimanded and got into deep trouble because of this loot. So that was just one of the little problems we got into. I always remember there was another party, again I was innocent of it, when after a fairly drunken evening, someone broke into an office in the building we were in, called it the officer's mess, and found a box there and threw it over, because the walls didn't go right up, they threw over one wall into another room. And it happened to be all the Padre's all the things he used for church services. The only little adventure I had at that time, I took another aircraft over, and then these were these new Spitfire lines to Cyprus, because they had a reconnaissance aircraft from Greece, flying over Corsica and looking, and they wanted to see if they get it. So I spent something like 2 weeks in Corsica, hoping this, and patrolling time to time, hoping this reconnaissance aircraft would be a J-88, would come over and I'd be able to have something to shoot at again. But unfortunately, I was unlucky. And I just sampled a lot of Cyprus brandy and eggs. If you swallowed an egg, raw egg, and then had a brandy and another raw egg, another brandy, you could drink lots of brandy.
So this period for yourself was quite boring.
Oh, it's frustrating and boring. And what annoyed me more, this is talking in retrospect, the people in Italy who, what I call, wanted to get in the war, went back to England for D-Day. And Raymond Baxter was one of those, went back. And he was made a squadron leader. And while I was rotting in Syria.
Was that a feeling that was common amongst a lot of your fellow pilots?
Well, I mean, you always got two sections. Those who said, God, this is nice and peace and quiet. I mean, I say probably a number of the married men, you know. This is, you know, let's stay here. But for me, I found it dreadful. It was awful.
What was Dutch Hugo like?
Dutch Hugo was a tremendous man, He was, again, a bit like Sheep Gilroy. The ship below got some recognition in a way that he came back to this country and stayed, lived there and farmed in this country. I remember Dutch Hugo was a good captain. He'd done well in the Battle of Britain. Very well decorated, I can't remember now, certainly DFC and bar, perhaps two bars. I always remember he came back to this country, and this happened all the time. If you hadn't stayed in the country, you were unknown to the establishment sort of thing. And I remember Dutch Hugo came back as squadron leader and was given nothing. Mm. Luckily, the war was coming to an end, so probably there wasn't a place to put him. So he disappeared back to South Africa. You know, but again, he didn't get the recognition he deserved. No, next to Sailor Milan, I probably admired Dutch Hugo as much as anybody else. He was tremendous leader, gave you lots of confidence. And he was a grand character.
How did that 6 month period in Syria come to an end?
Well, obviously the Turks didn't agree with Churchill, and we were told we were going back, into the Mediterranean War, and we equipped with these Spitfire 9s, which had a booster system that at height gave you much more speed, power. And we flew that long journey back. But we only got as far as Tripoli. Anyway, somewhere near Tripoli. And from there, I forget the exact base where. From there, we were told we were going to Corsica. And we were told, where there'd be an airstrip for us to land. This was rather interesting from my own personal point of view, because we got airborne, and I still had Shorty Langerman, the South African CO. He had engine problems and didn't take off. So I ended up thinking I was going to sit back and follow somebody else. Somebody had to lead the squadron to Corsica. Now then, again, single engine fighter pilots didn't like flying over water. And of course, when you're flying over that distance of water, of course, we'd have long range tanks. It's a lot of water and no land. And you're just going over this water and you're waiting. I hope you've got all your compass right and they've got the wind right and you're hoping and so forth. And you can't. You would, at that stage, you wouldn't get any directional flying help from the ground. You would just, and then you waited for land to come up, and of course Sardinia, and then you were happy then. So you flew over Sardinia or up the coast of Sardinia, and got to Corsica, and then you find your airstrip. Because I mentioned airstrips before. Remember, they're just bulldozed off out of anything. So it's not as if they stand out like sore thumbs. Sometimes they were difficult to locate. We located this airstrip, and obviously flew round it a couple of times to sort of get my bearings and find out where the wind was coming from and see, because you can't just land and then park in the middle of it. You have to start looking where aircraft could go or be parked. And these teams that go in, these, I used the word before, the commanders, they were tremendous people. I mean, they bulldoze spaces away for you to park the aircraft. But of course, a lot of dust around. So anyway, we landed, and once again, your equipment, or not your actual original equipment, but new equipment, like tents and things, would be there. Frequently, these air commanders would put up your tent for you and things like that, you see. But you start from scratch. Now, in Corsica, well, I'll cover this point in a moment, is on any maps shown of Corsica, the coastal plain on the Italian side was marked black for malaria, a lethal place for malaria. So it was decided we couldn't possibly live there. Otherwise, I'd have so much malaria and so on. So, so we had to live more up the mountains. So what you did, and I'm directly involved doing this, you get in a jeep, again, fortunately, that sort of thing is around, and you go and look for a campsite. Remember, in war is a funny thing. What somebody else is doing on that land or that is immaterial. It makes. And there was a river that flowed down up in these hills, and they grew olives on this, and I found this absolutely magnificent. Off this road, dipped down, saw all these olive trees, and along the river down a dip. That's a magnificent sight. So that poor man and his olives, that's the end of his olives and things. We just camped there. And it meant about a 15-minute, 20-minute drive to the airfield. But it was delightful living conditions. So that was our campsite for the whole time we were in Corsica.
And on the airfield, would you have, what, tented dispersed?
Oh, yes, tented dispersed. And we had what these can call orange boxes. They're vans like Montgomery used to have, you know, with glass windows and being, and we'd somehow have a telephone in there sometime, or sit in there, depending on the heat and so on. But we'd have a few tents around and things like that. In fact, that proved... it wasn't my decision that we wouldn't. It was a medical officer's decision that we couldn't stay on, live near the airfield. Medical officers did a hell of a lot of hard work in that sort of respect, getting you clean water, or telling you water you couldn't drink, and so on and so forth. I've lost my train now.
What was on the airfield? And the role of the medical officer.
Yes. Didn't know. Living away from the airfield proved very fortunate one night, because the Germans sent over quite a swarm of 109s with bombs and bombed our airfield. And I cannot say now, but the wing lost something like 20 aircraft. And I can't remember, but I think some of the ground crew were still on the airfield, were injured, may have been killed. I can't remember the details of that. But we stood on our hill campsite watching the airfield being bombed.
What time of... You said night time, but was it early evening or was it...
Yeah, I should imagine about 9 o'clock at night, 8 or 9 o'clock at night. They probably left at dusk from the Italian mainland. Now then, this was an interesting new situation, but though I never saw an American, our wing was actually part of the American 12th Air Force. And our main duty there, in the first instance, in fact, probably right the whole, my spell there, was to escort the American bombers coming from North Africa and anywhere else they were based. And we picked them up and then escorted them across Italy on all their tactical, mostly tactical bombing, knocking down bridges and that sort of thing. Once again, the Germans, knowing they'd lost their supremacy, were not very forthcoming. Of course, we flew in 90-gallon tanks. And the anti-aircraft fire, certainly for that 88-millimeter guns, they were very, very good at it. And my, just getting my own personal experience, though other people were lost to the guns, my two most serious incidents was from 88 millimeter fire when I was over there. Once, an 80mm shell went through my wing and obviously one of my undercarriage. And it's not pleasant seeing big holes in both your wing, apart from all the other flashes that's going on around. This is probably due to the fact that the aircraft we're escorting were going for targets which were highly defended, you see. But, I mean, they were very courageous, the Americans, the bomber people, you know, carrying on a straight line when all this stuff's coming up. I mean, they weren't being attacked by fighters because the fighters were put off with, because we're around. And I remember one or two comments from their leaders, and they're like code numbers, you know. I'll make up a figure, this is... black leader or something. I've got my little chicks with me. just give me, in other words, a friendly sort of touch with them. But I was hit by wing, but I had petrol and the engine was going.
With the shell, did it explode or did it pass?
Yeah, it passed through. And I came back, let everybody else land, and then may have been shot down, I can't remember. Anyway, whatever there was in the aircraft, let them land. And then I came to land and just landed on one wheel and kept the wing up. I switched off my engine, of course, when I touched down, so the propeller had stopped. And stick right over, trying to keep that way. But as soon as the airspeed is lost, you know, any air left, keep the wing slowly goes down. And you know when the remains of the undercarriage starts, because I had to put the undercarriage down, have one wing to land on, it starts digging in. All I expect to go turtle, you see. But fortunately, it went up onto its nose, hovered there, and then just stayed. So that wasn't so bad. I'm just talking about anti-aircraft fire now. Now, the next time, which was only about a fortnight later, I was flying along, and there was one almighty bang, and I was covered in petrol. Petrol just siphoned up from my long-range tank, which I jettisoned. And I said to Shorty Langerman, CEO, using whatever your call sign was, cheerio, good luck, you know, sort of, and opened my canopy to bail out. Then I had second thoughts. Oh, by the way, my number two had told me I was streaming petrol, you know, from the aircraft. But I was so covered that my shoes were obviously soaked in petrol. So there was no point in bailing out, you see. So I shut my head a bit, spoke to my number two and said, you know, has the petrol stopped flowing yet? Because I jetted out. He said, yes. And I said, am I losing anything else? He's smoking. No. I looked at my engine gauges, and the engine was still going. So I then said to Shorty, CEO, that I was going to try and make Corsica, because quite a lot of people went down on the way across to Corsica. So I set off, and I got back to Corsica. The engine was still going. When I got there, ground control suggested I went out to sea and bailed out, and they'd have And I told them, not on your Nelly. I wasn't going to bail out. But the problem was that there was petrol between the formers. There's petrol switching down on the floor of the cockpit. I said, I was saturated. And the reason they suggested that was they knew. See, the runway is a grit and dust and wire, and sometimes they have wire mesh across. As soon as I landed, the sparks, and that would be boom, you see. And of course, I knew that was going to be boom, you see. So I wasn't a happy fellow. On the other hand, and this happened quite a lot in war, when your mind's so occupied with what you're doing, you haven't got time to dwell on the worst situation. And so, once again, I said, let everybody else land. And then I'd come in and land. And I came to land. I'd open my cockpit door, strap myself in tight, put my flying goggles on, which never wore, but just as some sort of protection. And came to land, obviously shut my engine off before I, switched everything off, and landed. And, of course, everyone on the ground, because we had a fire engine there and an ambulance, and everyone waited for the big bang. There was no big bang. Now then, I think the Lord was being good to me, and or there was so much petrol, and as opposed to just gas, that it didn't ignite. And I just stepped out of that aircraft. A very shaken man. But not a flame, no smoke or anything. But in the long, taking the story longer, that was coming to the end of my, when that happened, I was getting to the end of my operational flying career. I was talking about not meeting many aircraft. But on the other hand, I did have one last opportunity flying from Corsica. I was operating over Viterbo. We came across some 109s. They were flying high. Now then, let's say, I can't remember height, it was above 20,000 feet. And these two were above me. And I suppose, again, confidence built from experience, but probably overconfidence. I opened my thrust. I'm going to climb up after these things. But normally, if someone's above you like that, you haven't got much chance because you've only got to dive away. Anyway, I went up. And the other thing, of course, I did against what I call the rules, I wasn't watching my back at all. I was flying a dead straight line, climbing. And kind of long story short, I got a 100% kill, two eyewitnesses in the squadron from it, you see. So that was, but just how foolish you could be. Now, this fellow wasn't going to attack me, I'm certain, but I swung round, obviously, because I hadn't got a lot of speed on the clock, because I'd been climbing, you see. But I turned around, and as close as that wall was, a 109 came past me. I think he was so scared and frightened he didn't want to know, you see. Otherwise, he could have shot me down, no trouble at all. or he was going so fast to get away. But the point was, I turned after him, but he was going probably, I don't know, 450 miles an hour, and so I tried to chase him, but he went. But the thing was, the lesson was that even in that situation, even with air support, you still should be looking out. Because if he wanted to, he could shot me down easily.
And the aircraft that you shot down, how did you achieve that with? You climbed?
I climbed and got within about 200 yards of him and opened fire. And, you know, by this time, you know, with the sailor man's training behind me, I was a pretty good shot. And he just. That was it.